The following presentation was recorded at the Buddhist Society of Victoria, Malvern East, Australia. Please visit our website at bsv.net.au.
Always nice to start with the Buddha's words on loving kindness. They're very uplifting, and I think chanting is one of those things that can be very beneficial. Some people enjoy it, some people don't, but it can give rise to energy in the body and the mind, actually, wake us up. So I'd like to, this talk is a continuation of what I have been talking about before. I should put everybody on the spot and say, what was I talking about before? People say, well, I'm not sure, it was a month ago. But I'll get on to the theme, so I'll let you off the hook there. But a friend of mine recently said to me, I think it was last week or the week before, there isn't enough joy in my life. This is the theme that I've been focusing on the last few months. There isn't enough joy in my life. And it reminded me of what Aya Khema said to me, actually, when I was at one of her retreats. It was a weekend retreat organized through the Buddhist Society, I think in 1994, January 1994, so a while ago. And, you know, I went to an interview with her. I was a layperson at the time. And I said to her, oh, I feel a bit, you know, flat. And I think I need something to inspire me, to be inspired. And she said, you have to inspire yourself. And I thought, yeah, that's really it. Bringing up inspiration, we need to do. Bringing up joy is something we need to do. We tend to think we want somebody else to do it for us, or some situation, some experience to bring up that inspiration or joy. But we can develop, we can trigger these positive emotions, bring them up in ourselves, and not necessarily have to wait for somebody to do it for us, as it were. And so I think this is, and it reminded me too, because somebody I know from India, you all know, probably a person who was here for a long time, Rajiv, and he was saying, you are the source of all my blessings. And I said, no, no, no. The blessings have to come from yourself, from your practice of ethical living, of looking after the mind and giving, you know, meditation is looking after the mind and wisdom. So this is where we look for developing these good qualities, not necessarily out there. And of course, the things that we experience in life, they can trigger these good qualities in us. They can bring it up. But if we didn't have the seeds of these good qualities, it wouldn't be possible to develop them. So I'm focusing, as I have been for quite a while, on the anusatis. And these are the meditations or recollections that focus on bringing up inspiration and joy. And I think most people will think, this is something I need in my life, the inspiration and joy. And this is something that is important for our practice, because meditation really doesn't succeed unless there is that joy, and that inspiration brings up the joy and triggers all the natural flow of the mind going towards samadhi. So this is something the Buddha taught. And he taught these six recollections, and I have done, over the last couple of months, I have done the recollection of the Buddha Nusati, the Dhamma and the Sangha, and last time I did generosity, covered that. And these are all things that can give rise to joy and to this inspiration and joy. And today I'd like to continue the series with the recollection of ethical living. That's what I've called it now. Sometimes called ethical conduct, morality, sometimes called virtue. But I think ethical living is quite relevant to people today. And I know last month, you may remember, Ajahn Sadaro talked about sila nusati, recollecting our virtue or recollecting our ethical living. Because the whole point of ethics is the way that we interact with the world through our actions, our speech, but also our mind. And the Buddha encouraged these recollections along with, there's four other recollections that he mentions, and some of them you know very well, but they're not in the group of six. The next, the last recollection in the group of six is the recollection of devas or devatas. And this is very interesting. I'll teach that next month about how one can go to a heavenly rebirth. It's very strange. I'll talk about that next month, why the Buddha would encourage people to go in that direction, because you always think, isn't it for nirvana? But I think he was very practical. Realized not everybody is ready for nirvana. They haven't got the wisdom, the understanding for it. And so those six recollections that I mentioned are the basic ones for bringing up joy. And also the other four is interesting. It doesn't necessarily, they can have the same effect. Mindfulness of breathing, I think everybody's aware of that, anapanasati, and mindfulness of the body, and recollection of the death, maranasati, and recollection of peace. And the Buddha says that all these ten, when they're developed and cultivated, they lead exclusively to disenchantment or turning away from sense pleasures, the sensory world, to dispassion, letting go of wanting, craving, to cessation of craving, to peace, to direct knowledge, and to enlightenment, to nirvana. So four works. Very interesting. I'm not sure about the devanusati, though. It seems like maybe it's a temporary station before going to nirvana, experiencing nirvana. So these are four bringing up this inspiration and joy in our lives. And, of course, I think nearly everybody needs this. And to really to be able to develop it for ourselves, to see what works for bringing it up. And so this one is going to be about ethical living. And, of course, these days, I saw on the internet, I thought, I'll have a look on ethical living, you know, to see if there's any interesting stories. And there's a whole range of different subjects people focus on. One of them is sustainable living. And I can sort of understand that because, you know, there has to be ethics involved with the taking care of the environment, not allowing our greed and competitiveness to really damage irreversibly the environment. And of course, you know, I remember last time I gave a talk on ethical living, somebody mentioned ethical investments. People are very concerned with that, and that's a very important consideration because sometimes these super funds and other investment schemes, they invest in things that are not necessarily ethical. They're using child labour or doing something that's not, or paying the workers very, very little, exploiting the workers. But of course, for the Buddha and the Buddha's teaching, this is not the main focus because ethics is concerned. We're not harming ourselves, not harming others, not harming both. And so this is through our actions of body, speech and mind. I think everybody would probably be very familiar with ethics in this in these terms, being a Buddhist audience. And the equality, the ethical quality, whether it be wholesome, that's sort of positive, or unwholesome, negative, will be determined by the intention or the motivation, where we're coming from. Is it a wholesome motivation or an unwholesome motivation? Is it coming from, you know, something like greed, selfish desire, competitiveness? Is it coming from, you know, ill will, anger? Is it coming from, you know, a sense of self, a very strong sense of ego, all those things, or not, the opposite? So, and of course we know how to, the Buddhist way of developing these, our ethics is through the precepts, isn't it? It's through the precepts. So I think everybody's familiar with that because it's what we use as a framework. And it's really interesting to me as Buddhists, we become very used to the five precepts or the eight precepts and the ten precepts, whatever. But we don't realize how rare they are in the world, how the clarity of these precepts is not something that's common. You know, many people in the world don't have this framework of, say, the five precepts. And though they have a sense of morality, it's very fuzzy. It's not clear-cut, whereas the Buddha is giving very, very clear-cut framework for us. And it's extraordinarily useful because we have something that can give us support, something that focuses us, makes us aware, because often our awareness can be very fuzzy because of greed, hatred and delusion. Our defilements can make it, or our egos. So we have the five precepts, of course, the 8 precepts, you've heard of them, the 10 precepts, and the 211 precepts for monks, and the 311 precepts for nuns. And so there are a lot of precepts, but most of them are not necessarily, you know, especially for the monks and nuns, to do with morality, to do with ethical living. They're to do with community harmony and that sort of thing, living in harmony together. There's also very useful teaching, one of the best, I think, and the Buddha emphasized again and again, the 10 causes of wholesome action and the 10 causes of unwholesome action. It's a marvelous thing with the Buddha's teaching. Absolute clarity, isn't it? You know, he usually gives the negative case and then the positive. So he makes it clear what he's talking about. And the clarity of that is incredible. So I will talk about some of these a little bit. The 10 causes of wholesome and unwholesome action a bit. And we all know the important thing with the precepts, of course, is there's the level of restraining or refraining from doing those things. And that is the minimum level. Ajahn Jagra used to call this, one of the teachers who came here, he called it the minimum level. It protects us. We won't do harm to ourselves and to others if we keep the precepts as much as possible. Keeping in mind, nobody will be perfect. And these precepts, the word for precepts is sikkhapada, isn't it? Sikkhapada. And I've seen, usually we say these are training rules. Sikkha is training, and pada can be rules, or I saw another translation of steps. That's an interesting one. So they are training rules, guidelines for us to live by. And that's really an important thing to keep in mind. It's not that we have to absolutely keep them perfectly. Can we keep them perfectly? It's probably asking a lot, unless we've got rid of, or unless all our defilements have gone. For an arahant, no problem. For an anagami, no problem. But even for a stream enterer and the once returner, they've still got defilements, so they would be breaking the precepts from time to time. But of course, the other side of practicing the of ethical living is developing the positive qualities. So we don't go there. You know, if we're looking out, to be kind and caring to beings, we won't kill living beings. And of course, this is in a sense, it's the shortcut for practicing the precepts. It also brings up a lot more happiness in the mind, because it's sometimes difficult for people to think, well, isn't it great that I didn't kill this being? But that is actually a very, very good thing, that one restrained, one didn't go there, didn't do it. But it's easier if we can see, actually looking out for beings, being thoughtful, being kind, rescuing them if they're in a difficult situation. And I know, you know, for me, for instance, when I was, you may think, well, this is a bit small, but sometimes even rescuing, when I was in Sri Lanka, ants from the toilet and things like that, you know, I just think, oh, you know, I know this being wants to live. It doesn't want to die in the toilet, thank you very much, drown there. So just to take it out, you know, using a brush or whatever. So this is a way we can, a very positive way, the side of development, and this is the side of right effort, of course. Right effort always two components, avoiding and letting go of the negative states of mind, and developing and maintaining the positive. And the developing the positive and maintaining it, of course, helps us avoid and let go of the negative. And of course, taking what is not given, that's the second precept of the five precepts. And of course, this is when we have honesty, and we can also, the opposite is practicing generosity, not looking to take, looking to give. And of course, this is a very important one. And sexual misconduct, of course, is in the area of developing contentment, reliability, faithfulness, all those. And I thought of it today. I thought, yeah, and loyalty too, because loyalty is a quality we greatly admire. And so this is something you notice when people have anniversaries for their relationship, for their marriage, that when you hear, oh, 50 years, you know, you think, oh, amazing, especially these days. And the opposite of lying, of course, truthfulness, you know, that's the fourth precept. And of course, in terms of the 12, path of 10 wholesome actions, you know, divisive speech, practicing. Divisive speech is dividing people. And of course, the opposite is bringing people together, bringing harmony and bringing unity. So this is practicing the opposite. And the same with harsh speech. This, sometimes I call it abusive speech because people can relate to that more, but it does include swearing and all that sort of thing as well. And instead, to have speech that people, and the Buddha mentions this, lovely descriptions of it, that's gentle, that's kind, that's pleasant to listen to, and welcomed. And of course, the other one is gossip and idle chatter. And of course, the opposite is developing speech that is meaningful and useful. And of course, the fifth precept, going back to the five precepts, alcohol and drugs, developing mindfulness and clarity of mind, the opposite, and will incline us away from anything that's really dulling the mind out. And then the 10 courses of wholesome action, they take it further. They go from three on the of coming from the body and from actions, four from speech, and three from the mind. And the mind is where it's all coming from, of course. And these are, first of all, envying what others have. We call it covetousness. It's a very old-fashioned word, very old-fashioned. So, and instead, you know, having joy and happiness, mudita, for people's good fortune, for what they have in their life, not envying them. And of course, ill will, avoiding ill will by developing metta, kindness, developing compassion, and all these positive qualities. And last of all, the wrong view. This is the 10th one of the unwholesome actions. And it's by straightening our views, is what they call it in Buddhism, but seeing according to reality. Because often if we have a wrong view, we will act on it. And if it is a wrong view, if it's not in accordance with reality, it can do a lot of harm for ourselves and for others as well, because we're just not seeing things clearly. So these wrong views actually are very dangerous for us, because we act when we act on them. So I was just going to mention a bit too why there is why there is a lack of joy in our lives. And I think that's good to look at. And it can come from, we're so used to being with ourselves that we don't really appreciate our good qualities. We think, well, they're just ordinary, that's normal. Everybody's like that, aren't they? And so we tend to take them for granted and miss the fact that these are actually good qualities that that can be a source of joy. This is what this recollection is about, making them a source of joy. And so it's a matter of looking in a right way at our lives, that when we aren't harming others, we aren't harming ourselves and not harming both. It's actually something that is great, is wonderful. Most of the world is not operating like that. And it's very, very interesting. There was I just saw recently a little video clip from, and it was showed a professor who had all his students and doing an exam paper, and they were sitting there and they turned the paper over, and the paper was blank except for a black spot. Some of you have seen this; it's going around at the moment. And he asked them to write about what their experience of this exam paper was. There was no question, just this black spot. And of course, all of them, what did they write about? The black spot and where its position was on the paper and so forth and how big it was probably and all that sort of thing. But what did they miss? The professor pointed out at the end of it. What did they miss? The white paper that it was on. That was the biggest part of it. And we're a bit like that. We miss the white paper in our lives because, you know, we're just focusing on the problems, the difficulties, our negative qualities often. And so this is, it reminded me of that. Instead of focusing on our good qualities, which are really a blessing. So it is, as I mentioned at the beginning of the talk, you know, just a way of looking inside, a way of looking differently, and to realize that ethical living is not a common thing. It's not that common in our society. Especially if you look at the news, there's a lot of killing, stealing, sexual misconduct in the news all the time, lying, and lots of stuff about alcohol and drugs and other substances. So it's this emphasis on not for going that way is actually quite uncommon, quite precious. So we can appreciate ethical living in those terms. And I think give ourselves a pat on the back. Why not? For doing that. It's always good to remember these recollections are for ourselves, not for advertising. It's not like we're going to get onto the internet and start telling everybody how great we are, you know, in terms of our ethical living. People would probably not be so impressed. And I wanted to emphasize one of the things about ethical living is that often we don't see it as important, but it is very important for our lives and for the Buddha's teaching too. And one of the things I often see in the Theragata and the Therigata, these are the verses of the enlightened monks and nuns, how much emphasis they put on it and how important it is for the path. And I think I will read. This is one of my favorite poems from the Theragata, actually. And it's the one about ethics. And the monk's name is Silawa, which I think Silawa is one possessed of Sila, one who has ethical living. And it says a lot about ethics, actually, I think. And it's very inspiring. If you haven't read those verses, there's a lovely translations by Ajahn Sajato, and they're available on Sutta Central. So I'll just read it, and you just see how you find it. One should train just in ethical conduct, for in this world, when ethical conduct is cultivated and well-trained, it provides all success. Wishing for three kinds of happiness, praise, prosperity, and to delight in heaven after passing away, the wise would take care of their ethics. The well-behaved have many friends because of their self-restraint, but one lacking ethics of bad conduct drives away their friends. A person whose ethics are bad has ill repute and infamy. A person whose conduct is ethical always has a good reputation, fame and praise. Ethical conduct is the starting point and foundation, the mother at the head of all good things. That's why you should purify your ethics. Ethics provides a boundary and a restraint, an enjoyment for the mind, and the ford where all the Buddhas crossed over. That's why you should purify your ethics. Ethics are the matchless power. Ethics are the ultimate weapon. Ethics are the best ornament. Ethics are a marvelous coat of armor. Ethics are a mighty bridge. Ethics are the unsurpassed scent. Ethics are the best perfume that float from place to place. Ethics are the best provision. Ethics are the unsurpassed supply for a journey. Ethics are the best vehicle that take you from place to place. In this life they're criticized. After departing, they grieve in a lower realm. A fool is unhappy everywhere because they are unsteady in ethics. In this life they're renowned. After departing, they're happy in heaven. A wise one is happy everywhere because they are steady in ethics. Ethical conduct is best in this life, but one with wisdom is supreme. Someone with both virtue and wisdom is victorious among humans and gods. That's lovely, isn't it? It's really beautiful. And obviously this is somebody who made ethics, ethical living, a big part of their practice, and their practice that took them all the way to enlightenment. So it's often there are suttas that you see where the Buddha starts from ethical living, keeping the precepts, and goes to, Ajahn Sadaro mentioned it last month, to non-remorse, and then to gladness, to joy, and then to rapture, and then to tranquility of body and mind, and then to samadhi, then to knowledge and vision of things as they are, and then to liberation. So it goes all the way to the end of the path. So it's a very important aspect of the practice. Often people think, well, you know, meditation's the important thing. This ethical side, well, yes, you know, maybe. So the course, and when we see the benefit of practicing of ethical behavior, you see that, you know, we're not hurting others, not hurting ourselves. We're not creating karma, bad karma, through our actions of body, speech and mind. We're creating good karma, actually. And as I mentioned, it's a foundation for the whole path. So this is the importance of ethics and the value of keeping it. And of course, the Buddha praised it. And when you think of it, it's three factors out of the Noble Eightfold Path, isn't it? Three out of eight. That's to do with ethics. So it's a very important aspect of our practice. And how do we practice it? Now this is it. Hopefully I've got enough time how to practice. This is the part, this is the focus, isn't it, really? One, I mentioned already that we shouldn't, when we practice the recollection of our ethical behaviour, we shouldn't, or ethical living, we shouldn't focus on, expect ourselves to be perfect. And I think that's unrealistic, as I mentioned. And even a stream enterer, who they say is perfect in sila, perfect in ethical living, can break the precepts. But what they can't do is hide it. So it's mentioned in the Ratana Sutta that they will always, you know, if they've broken the precepts, they will always tell somebody else and then recommit to it. And so it's we need to just to focus on really the successes we've had in our practice of the precepts of ethical living, because we will have had precepts, not on the failures, because that's the tendency to go for the black dot. People are always going for the black dot, not seeing the rest of the picture, the paper, the white paper. And so we focus on those, and it will encourage us to develop them more when we see our successes. And as I mentioned, it will put it in, put the practice of ethical conduct, ethical living into perspective. And also it can be good, in a sense, to bring up the sense of comparison by thinking how fortunate we are, as I mentioned before, to have these precepts, these guidelines, and that most people don't have them, and what a valuable thing they are. And I've heard this from a number of people again and again, actually. I remember one doctor I know who works in prison. She said she told a prisoner about them, and he was so impressed. He thought that if he had heard these, maybe he wouldn't be in prison. And also heard of another person who told me that when they came across the five precepts, they were so happy to see them, and particularly the fifth precept about not taking alcohol and drugs, because even though he wasn't really a drinker, he felt that he had to socially have a drink. And when he saw the precepts, took the precepts, it gave him a lot of support. So this is something that's of great value. And of course, seeing the benefits is very important in it. So I'll read a description the Buddha gives of how we practice this recollection of our ethical behavior or ethical living. And this is his description of that. Yeah. He starts out, actually, interestingly, this is to Mahanama. Mahanama was his cousin, actually, and he gave a lot of quite a few teachings to him about how to bring up inspiration and joy. So I think he must have needed it, actually. And it starts out, now we spend our lives in various ways. Which of these should we practice? And this is what Mahanama is asking the Buddha. And, of course, the Buddha starts to begin with, he says that, he says here, we spend our lives in various ways. Which of these should we practice? And he says, the Buddha told him, the faithful succeed, not the faithless. The energetic succeed, not the lazy. The mindful succeed, not the unmindful. Those with samadhi succeed, not those without samadhi. The wise succeed, not the those that are not wise. When you're grounded in these five things, go on to develop six further things. That's the recollections. So it's obviously giving him quite a bit of material to go on with, actually, to bring up joy in his life. And if you recognize, I think people will recognize those as the indriyas, the five faculties. And it just occurred to me, Ajahn Brahm, when he was teaching it, used to teach it a lot, and he would talk about them as the controlling faculties. And they are the controlling faculties for developing the mind in good qualities. And we all have these controlling faculties, but we also have some competitors, the hindrances, the defilements. And of course, once a person reaches the first stage of enlightenment, these controlling faculties will take over. They are what's directing the mind, controlling the mind, taking it in the direction of enlightenment. And for us, you know, we have, as I said, competition, because the defilements are directing our minds, saying, oh, I must go to this shop, I must see this on the internet, I must do this, I must have that food. All these things are really taking the mind in all various directions. So these indriyas are the controlling faculty, very important. And this is how the Buddha describes the recollection on ethical living. Furthermore, a noble disciple recollects their own ethical conduct, which is unbroken, impeccable, spotless, and unmarred, liberating, praised by sensible people. Interesting translation. I suppose Bhikkhu Bodhi has the wise, and not mistaken, and Bhikkhu Bodhi says ungrasped, and leading to samadhi, leading to stillness, to oneness of mind. So this is emphasizing, of course, you know, that's especially when the Buddha mentions that they are unbroken, impeccable, spotless, and unmarred, emphasizing keeping the precepts, but he's emphasizing the purity of keeping them. And of course, as I mentioned, for a stream enterer or above, the first stage of enlightenment or above, that's much easier than before. It's almost, you'd say, natural. It's almost natural. And of course, this keeping of the precepts, restraining, is what we need to do to our best of our ability, but not to be too critical of our shortcomings, not to be critical of our failures, as I mentioned before. Because if we do, anyone think that will bring up joy? Inspiration? I don't think so. So this is a bit of a tightrope, really, to really steer the mind in a positive direction, to see when we've had successes in our practice of keeping the precepts. And sometimes they can be really, really uplifting and encouraging, because we think, wow, I wouldn't have been like that before, you know. And that's another way, actually, we can bring up more inspiration and joy, is thinking, well, previously, I wouldn't have been able to do that, you know, restrain myself in that situation. I would have definitely said something or done something. So that can bring up joy. So, and I think Ajahn Sadhguru mentioned last month that this recollection is not for beating up on ourselves. And I think that is a very good point, because it won't bring joy. There's no way. But what is really something can bring up joy in us is, and inspiration, is a commitment to keeping the precepts, not just on special occasions. The five precepts, of course, they're something we can keep every day. We can use for our guideline for living in the world, and make them an important part of our life, where we're coming from. And of course, when we practice ethical living, that sincerity is an important aspect of it, and also self-honesty, to be honest as well. But what is the most important quality we need when we're practicing ethical living? Kindfulness, to be kind. That avoids the beating up and all that. And this is right motivation, the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. How we should practice the Noble Eightfold Path. It's not to be hard on ourselves, not to harm ourselves, not to hurt ourselves or others. And so this is an important thing. And I like what Bhante Gunaratana said in his book, The Eight Mindful Steps to Happiness, Noble Eightfold Path. He said, we practice skillful action. This is the right speech, right action, and right work or livelihood, because we can see the consequences of such unskillful actions, that they lead to profound unhappiness for us and everyone around us. And now and in the future, we practice skillful action because we want our lives to be helpful and harmonious, not destructive and contentious, and because we want a calm and happy mind, untroubled by regret and remorse. It's pretty good, actually. So that's one of the things you see with all of the Buddha's teaching, is that whatever part of the practice we're using, whether it be giving, whether it be ethical living, whatever, it's for developing good qualities of the mind. And they are the things we can take with us from this life to the next. So this is very important that we emphasize the positive things too that we are doing. You know, we're not harming other beings. We're actually saving lives in whatever way we can, taking care, having compassion, and so forth. All those positive aspects. And Buddha mentions that it's liberating. And of course, it liberates us from our defilements. It liberates us, especially the precepts, the ethical behavior, ethical living. It is reducing the coarser defilements of speech and action. And it's a preparation for refining the mind. The Buddha uses the simile, the sutta called gold refining, about refining the mind like gold, little by little. You start from the coarse, removing or reducing as much as possible, the defilement through speech and action, and then you get onto the mind, the more subtle, deeper defilements from the mind, developing the mind. And praised by the sensible is actually praised by the wise. And this should be our guideline, actually, in life. If you look at the internet, there are many influencers on the internet. I don't know that they'd be qualified as the wise or even indeed as the sensible sometimes. Important that those influences in our lives should come from wise beings, beings that have kindness, that have the depth of experience and understanding, that can guide us, can be an inspiration to us. And of course, not mistaken is the part of that, part of how the Buddha describes ethical living. And of course, this is practicing it correctly. Or I like Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, ungrasp. So we're not taking it as a me, an I, a mine. So we're not making an ego trip out of our sila and leading to samadhi. This is very important because this is the springboard where we can dive into wisdom, where we can dive into seeing things as they are, when we can understand the Four Noble Truths from experience. And the Buddha continues, when a noble disciple recollects their own ethical conduct, their mind is not full of greed, hatred, and delusion. Hopefully not having gone towards the negative thing, what'd I do? So this is where the mind can be free of the defilements and it can start to develop the factors that lift the mind. And these defilements, they really distort our vision of how life is, our vision of reality. They are the things that make it difficult for us to see things as they are. And he continues, at that time, their mind is unswerving, so it's undistorted, I would say, based on their ethical conduct. And from that, when the mind is unswerving, they find inspiration in the meaning and the teaching. And from that, joy connected with the teachings. And when they are joyful, rapture arises. This is piti. And when the mind is full of rapture, the body becomes tranquil, disappears in meditation. And when the body is tranquil, they feel bliss or happiness. And when they're blissful, the mind becomes immersed in stillness or samadhi. So this is the importance of this recollection. It's taking the mind, bringing joy and inspiration, and taking it towards the mind coming together. And this is the interesting bit where the Buddha says, you should develop this recollection on your own ethical conduct whilst walking, standing, sitting, lying down, while working. Interesting. And while at home with your children. Bhikkhu Bodhi has a nicer translation of that last bit. While living at home in a house full of children. Now that's, I think, recollecting with a house full of children is it's going to be pretty challenging. But so this is the recollection on our own ethical conduct. But one of the things I think myself, and I'm sure you find it too, is we can develop inspiration and joy from other people's practice of ethical conduct. So it's well worth bringing that to mind when we do a short guided meditation, just 5 minutes. So really, when you look at this, it's a 24/7 practice. If you're doing it at home while you're walking, standing, sitting, lying down, and while the kids are around, probably while the TV's on. So very interesting. Practice on ethical living. So maybe you just do a little sampler, and tomorrow evening I have to do I'll do a little bit more on ethical living, recollecting ethical living. So we can just come into the present moment. Nothing we need to do and nowhere we need to go. and just checking out, adjusting the body if it needs any adjustment, and relaxing the body from top of the head to the toes. Just being present. And just to bring to mind the importance of ethical living. Is it important to me? Does it make a difference to my life? Is it valuable? And we can remember any occasions when we didn't say something or do something we know that would be hurtful. How did we feel when we didn't go there, as it were? And we can remember other occasions when we did something that was affirmative, saving life or taking care of someone or an animal, taking care of another person's property, of being faithful, being loyal in our relationships, being truthful in a kind way. And occasions when we're very clear-minded and aware. And if we can remember someone whose ethical living we were impressed by, that really we admired, that we felt a sense of inspiration or joy, somebody can live like that. So, with such integrity. Such strength. And we can just reflect for a few moments on how we feel now after this very short recollection of ethical living. Did it bring up any sparks of inspiration or joy or sense of gratitude that we have such a teaching on ethical living? And did we see the causes for these feelings to come up? Causes that we can encourage in the future, in our lives. And now we can come out of this brief recollection and move the body and open our eyes. So, just like to conclude by saying, let's inspire ourselves, let's bring joy to our lives by things like recollecting ethical living, by recollecting our generosity, by recollecting the Buddha, the wonder, the amazing qualities of the Buddha, by recollecting the Dhamma, that we're so lucky to have a teaching like this in the darkness of modern life, and also recollecting the Sangha, those that have practiced fully and realized the teachings of the Buddha, that can be a great light for us, an inspiration for us. So this, in order to bring up this joy and happiness leading to stillness and the deep wisdom beyond, that's the whole point. And of course, to freedom from suffering, freedom from defilements, freedom from being born again and again, stuck on repeat. So I'd like to thank you for listening this morning. And hopefully you find it useful. I think this ethical living is such an important part of our lives. So if we can really appreciate its importance and its value for us, and thereby, you know, bring up some joy in when we are successful in our practice of the precepts and ethical living. So thank you very much. There we are. Now time for Q&A, I think. Anyone on the Discord yet? No, don't you? It's a terrible name, isn't it? Discord. We want Concord. That's what we want. We want to change it to Concord. That wasn't a great success either. That was the name of a plane that they built quite a few years ago. I think it was, yeah. Any comments, questions or complaints? This ethical behaviour, no. Ethical living. No, there we are. Yes. Oh, there's one over there. Ah, there we are. Yeah, Katrina. Yeah, sorry, there. Yeah, now then they can hear it online. So otherwise they hear,
One of the things I've been thinking about lately is, because usually I make decisions very easily. I know where I feel right. It's never been a problem. But sometimes there's been real confusion because I'll go, that's my gut. That's like the truth. And I go, oh, no, but it's not. And then, like you said something about, swinging back and forth. Yeah. I can't remember the words you used, but I was like, yeah, that's what it feels like. And then because you doubt, you think, oh, no, is this really, my gut instinct or, you know, intuition or, you know, the truth? I'm seeing things really. Yeah. Or is it actually now defilement and now I'm, like, projecting onto. I don't really know how to get through that.
Yeah, it is a hard one for all of us, you know, when we have to deal with difficult decisions and how to, because we're very much committed to getting the right decision, how do we do this? And of course, that emphasis on having to feel like we need exactly the right, the perfect decision, puts a bit of pressure on us, doesn't it? Certainly does. And I think one of the best ways I find is actually intuition, but coming from having meditated, allowing things to get really settled down, get more peaceful, and then just to see what comes. Because that process, I think we can trust more. Because when we meditate, when we're in the present moment, then these defilements can reduce. And it's what the defilements are, what actually are skewing, what are distorting, as I mentioned in the talk, our decision-making, really, our thought process. But sometimes with the with meditation, this can all die down, and then, you know, something can pop up in the mind, which maybe, you know, I found sometimes very unexpected. And it takes the burden off us if we say, mind, what should I do? You know, we always think, what have I got to do? And then then we feel quite a pressure, you know. But if you say, well, mind, well, you know, what would be the best decision, best option in this situation? And then once we have stepped back a bit, somehow that enables the process. And particularly, as I mentioned, if the defilements are reduced somewhat, that makes it, the clarity much, much clearer. And as you say, then the gut feeling, and there's a certain rightness that comes with it when we come from an intuitive place. Might not always get it right, but certainly it makes it clearer and easier. Because I think for any of us, you know, going through indecision is a very, it's very, you know, it takes our energy, and, you know, and we go back and forth, as you say, swinging. And so this is one way that I think is very, very good. The other way that like Ajahn Brahm, he says, you know, if you've got a decision, you flip a coin, and one side is, I'll do it, the other side, I won't do it. Whatever way the coin comes up, don't do it. Just see how you feel. And I think that's very true. Sometimes we think, oh, yeah, should I do it? Shouldn't I do it? But when you say, I'm not going to do it, oh, no, I have to. It makes it really, really clear. It takes it out of the sort of theoretical into the really, you know, the heartfelt, where I really, what I really want to do. So I think that's another good way to do it as well, you know. So thank you for that, Katerina. That's a good question. I think one we can all relate to. So, and is there any from the Discord people?
Not discordant yet, Ajahn, but we have some YouTube questions.
Yes, good.
The first question is online is, when is the right time to do anusatis? Is it in meditation or before meditation?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think if you look at the anusatis, the way they develop, they really are what you do to develop the meditation, really. And if they really bring up that sense of joy, that inspiration and that joy, then it will lead to the developing the meditation automatically, as it were, or naturally going towards samadhi. So it would be best to do it in meditation and not, you know, while you're working. And though, you know, if you're doing it in other settings, isn't it? It's just bringing up that happiness and joy in the mind. It won't, you know, you're not going to go into samadhi while you're working. I don't think that's probably unlikely. But if you're sitting on a cushion, I think you've got a much better chance, you know, if you really get in contact with that joy and that inspiration and joy. And the important thing with these recollections, with practicing any of the good qualities in that the Buddha recommends, is that they're not a personal thing. We take them very personally. They think, I can't do that. You know, some of you hear it quite often. Men often say, I can't do metta, you know. But it is just a quality in our minds. And all of these, the recollections are focusing on these qualities that can be developed if the mind is looking in the right way. This inspiration and joy will naturally come up. And it's one of the things that Buddha emphasized again and again, that this is a process. It's not driven by an ego, an I or a me. We're not doing ethical behavior, the recollection of ethical behavior. We're triggering these qualities in the mind to go in a direction that the Buddha says perfectly natural and will take us towards samadhi. So this is we can all do it. That's the point of it. So I hope that gives you an idea. So that's very good to do it as a preliminary for the meditation, as a primer, because it can give rise to that energy and joy, give rise to that rapture, give rise to the tranquility of the body and the mind, and then happiness, and then samadhi. So it is a good preliminary, and if it doesn't, I think it would at least bring up some good feelings, warmth in the mind, a certain sense of happiness that will be useful for the meditation. So I would say as a preliminary, just as Ayakema, she often emphasized doing metta, loving kindness, before each meditation, you know, just to overcome the hindrances, and then maybe even and take us deeper into the meditation, because it's the hindrances, basically the negative qualities in our minds, that make meditation difficult, make wisdom difficult. So I hope that was useful for the person on the chat. Yeah, any complaints? Not ethics again.
There is one more online question, Ajahn, if have time for one more.
Yeah, I think we have. Just one more, and then,
Could you speak about finding the balance in establishing ethical conduct between the craving to get rid of unethical behavior and the craving to become a better person?
That's a very good, question. It's probably requires a very lengthy answer, but it's obviously driven by this trying to get rid of things and become a better person. So there's a certain degree of ill will in there, so it's a hindrance. There's quite a degree of I'm going to do this, so there's a lot of willpower in there, and there's. In a sense, we're stepping back from being wise about it and being kind about it. And so the kindfulness is very, very important, as I mentioned. And it's a very natural for all of us to think, well, this is awful. This feeling I have in my mind from having done something, said something, is awful. And it's very natural to want to get rid of it. But if we have kindfulness, we just think, well, yeah, I messed up. Bad things happen. And then just let it be, not to dwell on it, to make it, something into a more negative experience, because that's not going to help us in improving our ethical living. And the same, this idea of improving ourselves all the time really means we can't accept ourselves as we are just now, as we are. This is how we are, this moment, whatever that state of mind be, whatever our practice of ethical living be, that's how it is at the moment. But it's not set in concrete, and because it's non-self and because it's not driven by a person, by an ego, the mind can develop in this direction. This is possible for all minds to go in that direction. Given the right causes and conditions, that's what will happen. So I think this is a very, very good question. Very good. But always the answer is kindfulness is the way forward. So thank you very much for that one. And I'd like to finish off by short dedication of merits. I'm getting into the habit, actually. It seems to be the habit. And to dedicate merits to Shirley Tan. Some of you might know Shirley Tan. She was in Western Australia, and she was a long-time supporter of the monastery. She used to come every Monday with her sister Sally and another group of Malaysian Chinese people. And Shirley passed away, aged 88, not bad, on the 8th of June. And she's been such a good supporter of Ajahn Brahm's monastery, the nuns' monastery, Dhammasara, in Western Australia. And her brother, of course, was the Venerable Dhammavuddha in Malaysia. Some of you will have heard of him. He's a well-known teacher who passed away a few years ago. And, of course, even more locally, her sister is Aya Gotami, one of the nuns at Dhammasara, the nuns' monastery in Western Australia. So, we wish Shirley a good rebirth, an excellent rebirth, where she can meet up with Buddha Dhamma and Sangha again. I think she's got all the good conditions, so I wish her well. And again, just to mention, the second dedication is to for Mr. Kumar Punchihava's late wife, Mrs. Dumdara, or Dummy, that's what we used to say, Dummy, Punchihava, who passed away on the 27th of June 2019. So it's 4 years. And he and his wife, they started up a place in Colombo for monks and nuns, for both the Sangha, actually wonderful, and also been instrumental in supporting the New Zealand Bhikkhuni Hermitage in Hamilton, so really great. And the last dedication is really, it's a sharing of merits with Venerable Vimalarangsi. And many of you heard of Venerable Vimalarangsi, who used to, he came here and did a retreat in Ripplebrook, I remember 2017, sometime around there. And he's now in the US, and he's passing away. He may have passed away by now. I just saw a video yesterday of some monks and nuns chanting by his bedside. So he's, we can share merit with him as well. So just a short dedication merit now, and then we can probably do it next door too. Idang bo nyati nang ho tu sukita hon tu nyatayo. Idang bo nyati nang ho tu sukita hon tu nyatayo. Idang bo nyati nang ho tu sukita hon tu nyatayo. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. There we are, wishing them a very good rebirth, or if possible, no rebirth. That's asking a lot, though. That's asking a lot. And for those who would like to, we can pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, and please come over for the shared meal now, very soon, actually, 11 o'clock. There we are.